Welcome to Curious Canadian History. I'm your host, David Boris. Prince Edward Island is one of the most beautiful provinces in Canada. Its wind-swept beaches are stunning. Its friendly people are some of the friendliest in this entire country. It has beautiful golf courses, scenic terrain. Its people have a proclivity for incredible music inspired by both Celtic and French roots. It is the setting for Anne of Green Gables. It has a deep, almost magical connection to the waters that surround it. And if you can catch the perfect day at the perfect hour, it feels like a small piece of heaven. However, in this show, we haven't really talked much about that province. It's kind of slipped through the historical cracks, and that's on me. Today, I want to take a small step towards rectifying that, because one of the most interesting stories about PEI is how it came about joining Canada. Despite the first of the Confederation conferences occurring in Charlottetown, PEI was eventually left off the roster when the Dominion of Canada was first formed. Why did it not join in 1867? What occurred to make it join in 1873? These questions and more are answered today. This is Season 8, Episode 13, The Little Island That Could, Prince Edward Island and Confederation. To explore our subject matter today, we brought in an expert, and that expert is historian and podcaster Christopher Dummett. Christopher is a professor at Trent University. He is the author of the book Unbuttoned, A History of Mackenzie King's Secret Life, and he runs the podcast 1867 and All That. There are two full seasons now with 24 episodes. It's like a history of Rome, but for Canadian politics. And of course, Christopher is a lover of good stories. I began our discussion by asking Christopher to give us some background context to the discussions over Confederation in the 1860s.
All right. Well, I mean, I'd say essentially it's a Canadian story, but by Canadian, I don't mean that what we think of as Canada now is in all the provinces across Canada. It's a Canadian story, and then it's the province of Canada, which included Upper Canada and Lower Canada, what we now think, or Canada East, Canada West, what we now think was Quebec and Ontario. I mean, the whole push for a British North American Union to join these colonies together is fundamentally a Canadian problem. And it's to solve a Canadian problem. It's a Canadian problem that was created when Upper and Lower Canada were pushed together in 1841 in the Union of the Canadas. After the rebellions of 1837 and 38, people know about Lord Durham's report, come in and investigate the causes of what went wrong. And the British are trying to think, how do we prevent this from happening again? And, you know, the solution is to push these two colonies together in a single province. And they do it in this kind of fascinating and in some ways unfair way, which is to say that they give equal representation to the two sections in the assembly. So each side gets kind of 42 seats in this assembly. And initially, the lower Canadians, especially the French Canadians, are furious about this. For they're furious for a bunch of reasons, but they're furious because they have a larger population. This is really they're saddled with this, you know, with being underrepresented. The problem is that over the course of the 1840s, 1850s, the Canada West population, Upper Canada's population, just continues to grow at a faster rate than Lower Canada, Canada East. And they are, so increasingly it's Canada West, who was perfectly happy in the 1841 to have equal seats. Now they're furious. This is so undemocratic. How could this be the case? So that's one, that's the main issue. And so the Canada West politicians, especially a guy eventually comes to be the head of the kind of main opposition force, a guy named George Brown, head of the editor of the Globe newspaper, you know, ferocious debater, fascinating guy. And he wants, and as other people of his allies want, rep by pop, representation by population, equal, you know, basically, it's essentially a very democratic argument. They want the representatives in the assembly to be kind of roughly equal in terms of who they represent as voters. So it all sounds fine, except in the at the end of the 1840s, I know this is a long backstory, but it's useful to get the long backstory. At the end of the 1840s, the Canadas first, well, Nova Scotia first, and the Canadas win what's called responsible government, which is essentially the British Westminster-style democracy in North America. They Canadians win their – the foundations of Canadian democracy are really in that those fights for responsible government. And by 1848-49, the Canadas have fundamentally won responsible government. So Parliament really matters now. The governors who had previously – you know, they'd certainly listen to the assemblies. The assemblies have been powerful, but now the governors are increasingly less powerful. It's the assemblies who are, and the cabinets who are having this great power. And so these issues really come to matter. And then the final element of this recipe of what becomes this recipe of instability and kind of chaos is all the divisions within the Canadas, linguistic and especially religious, right? You know, you just can't overestimate the importance of religious factionalism to the Canada of the 1850s and 1860s. This mattered as profoundly as all the culture war issues, more than they do now, but issues of race. Religion is so, and it's tied up also in ethnicity around Irish Catholics, French Catholics. So it's tied into ethnicity, but religious fundamentally matters. Religion fundamentally matters. And French Canadians are pretty good at voting as a bloc. Together, they see themselves as having a national interest in voting together, and the other Canadians, English Canadians in Lower Canada, so there's a certain number in Lower Canada, and in Upper Canada, then but they're quite divided by a whole series of loyalties, of political beliefs, and so the faction amongst the faction that wins essentially initially the Reformers, and then by the 1850s the Conservatives is the faction which can ally with the large French Canadian bloc. But, okay, all these things together. But by the end of the 1850s and into the 1860s, the thing is Canada West population has grown so much. There's such division within Canada West that any faction that comes to head up the government is just very unstable. And so that by the 1860s, you're having governments come in and get voted out, get voted in and voted out. And there's just a real frustration with being able to solve problems. And there's also a growing, you know recognition even amongst Canadian Tories, say those who follow John A. Macdonald and his party that's allied with the French Canadian bloc, who had previously not been in favor of rep by pop because it kind of benefited them to ally with the French Canadians. And they couldn't guarantee that they would be the faction which would come out of English Canada if they did get rep by pop. So many of their supporters by the early 1860s think it makes sense. It becomes increasingly difficult not to do this. So 1863, 1864, there's a kind of rise and fall of a series of these governments. And you get this point where in 1864, kind of in the spring and summer of 1864, it looks like there's going to be another government's going to fall, and they're going to have to go to another election, which will be inconclusive. And then George Brown, the kind of impossible man who thought you could never really form a government because he was hated by so many French Canadians, couldn't really lead a government. In the midst of this, he does this really unexpected thing. He lets it be known that he would be open to supporting a kind of coalition government with his enemies, his personal enemy John A. Macdonald, who he's got a real beef with, and Georges Etienne Cartier, the leader of the French Canadian bloc, and others. Now he doesn't initially want to be part of himself, although he's later convinced he should be part of it. But he kind of presents this olive branch. Says, "Okay, I'll be part of this coalition if the aim of the coalition isn't to govern indefinitely, but is to create a wider union of British North America." And so this is the kind of real turning point in the Confederation story. There's been a Canadian problem which has grown up. And so George Brown does this kind of amazing thing, says, "Okay, I'll go against what have been some of my principles if we can get this thing I want." Because he wants and insists that if it happens, he'll get rep by pop.
Interesting. So George Brown is really kind of the trigger man on this whole momentum, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. It's funny because obviously, you know, Johnny McDonald gets a lot of credit because he's such a he's the vastly more skilled politician. But McDonald, until really the last minute, he's speaking against British North American Union and Confederation. But he's very astute politically, and so as soon as it seems like this is a possibility, he just turns around and says, "Okay, let's do it," and then heads to the front of the flock.
So, okay, great. So we established this very, like you said, this very Canadian problem. And George Brown sort of is the first to sort of say, look, let's try to break this political deadlock effectively. And George Brown's vision is sort of this wider, not Confederation necessarily yet, but this wider sort of political body. So let's move over to Prince Edward Island then. So at the same time that this is kind of going on in the Canadas, what is going on demographically, politically, and economically in Prince Edward Island?
So PEI is, I mean, I think it's one of the most fascinating provincial histories that probably everyone outside of PEI, maybe many people in PEI don't know. PEI is this unique province within Canada that is created very unlike just about any other, which is to say, when the British take control of what was called Île Saint-Jean, St. John Island, in after the Treaty of Paris, after everyone knows the Battle of the Plains of Abraham, but, you know, that's when St. John Island later becomes Prince Edward Island, becomes part of the kind of British Empire. There are only like several hundred people, Acadians, Mi'kmaq, living on the island. It's largely uninhabited on a full-time basis. And so the British decide that they're going to treat that island very differently. They're going to separate it apart from the rest of Acadia. And they're going to say, okay, we're going to treat that very differently. And they hold a lottery, which is to say a land lottery. They divide the island into 67 different massive estates, and they allow essentially loyalists in England to join this lottery. And they're provided, they win, or they purchase in some ways through this lottery. They're offered the chance to purchase these massive landed estates. And so this is different than every other place where land grants, sometimes there are large land grants, but the idea is you're gonna have individual farmers taking up private property, and that's the real push. So PEI does this very different thing. And now the British government wants and it insists that the landowners settle these estates. And they actually want them to settle them from Protestants outside the British Empire, which never really happens. And for a variety of reasons, that isolation, the difficulty of this, that never really happens. It's very difficult to settle. There's the American Revolutionary Wars intervene, the Napoleonic Wars. And so most of the settlement that happens in PEI comes really in the period after the Napoleonic Wars, after 1815. By the time we get the 1860s, you know, PEI is settled by a kind of a mix of Protestants and Catholics, not an equal mix. The Catholics are in the minority, but they're a pretty substantial minority, Scotch and Irish mostly. But the politics of PEI, you know, you have the same stories there about the fight for responsible government that happened, you know, and PEI gets it in the early 1850s. You get the same kinds of politics. But the one unique feature is this whole land question, because the people who eventually settle in PEI, many of them do not have freehold tenure, right? And they are they're tenants, or many, in some cases, they're squatters. And so they're kind of insistent on, you know, getting their own property rights. They want to purchase the lands, but often the landlords aren't keen to sell their properties. The landlords are almost all absentee landlords still in Britain. They see these big estates as just kind of land investments, right? So not what the British government wanted them to do. They're represented on the island by these agents, these land agents, who are really the upper middle class, the administrative class of PEI for the most part. These people who are acting on behalf of the landlords in connection with the tenants, and they are the kind of educated elite in the colony. And everyone thinks they're kind of getting screwed. So the landlords think they're not getting enough rent, and there's the tenants are always going into arrears on their rent. And then there are all these local customs which happen. So you're not going to pay interest on your arrears. And so they're upset. The land agents feel torn between them, and the tenants and squatters feel, you know, they can't purchase their land. They're different. They can't. If they make improvements on the land, they're not going to benefit from that. So all of the politics of the island so much focus on this land question. a whole bunch of people try to solve problems. There's a radical movement in the 1830s to try and take the rights of the landlords away from them. The Escheat movement, it's called, and that fails. And so if we take you right up to the eve of Confederation, there's a big land commission, which gets established in 1860, which tries to find a solution. And they essentially probably do find a good solution, but the British government, at the behest of the proprietors, the landholders, they nix it and don't go along with it. So on the eve of Confederation, PEI it's got a responsible government, it's got a politics centered around land, and they're looking for a solution.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, that's interesting. So you have this movement towards Confederation in the Canadas. You have PEI with this very serious land issue. We do know that the maritime colonies have also been discussing broadly a form of maritime union as well, right? So when PEI is first approached, what do they lay out as their sort of concerns? Okay, if you want us to join, here are the things we need to have taken care of. And obviously, I'm sure the land question is going to be part of that.
I mean, I would say initially disinterest is the
main interesting. Term. Go ahead. Could you explain more about that if you don't mind?
Yeah. I mean, I think so the idea of maritime union, which is floated for around, you know, which is basically rejoining up all of these areas which had been divided up, because it had been all of one Acadia under New France, and they say, let's join them all back up together and create this kind of single province. And, you know, it's kind of an intellectually interesting idea, and it's taken up by, in the 1860s, various people, but in particular, the governor of New Brunswick, Arthur Gordon. And, you know, there's not a lot of interest in it. I would say there's certainly not a popular excitement about it, but the Maritimers, in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, what they really want is a railroad joining both to the U.S. but then also to the Canadas. They want access to markets, right? They want to be part of the dynamic market of the day, and railroads should do that. And at a moment when the possibility of an intercolonial railway, a railway joining Canada to the Maritimes, it's being discussed, seriously discussed, and then it seems to fall away. It's in that one moment that they say, maybe we should resurrect this maritime union idea. And so it seems to be going ahead. They say, we should hold a conference. But the fact is, and this is all happening in 1864 in the lead up to what's going on in the Canadas. So when the Canadians decide, okay, we're going to form a new government to have British North American Union, they say, and then Governor General Lord Monck in Canada writes down to his maritime counterparts, the lieutenant governors there, and says, okay, the Canadians would like to come to your conference that you're going to host on maritime union. The Maritimers are like, oh, I guess we better organize that conference. They hadn't set a date. They hadn't set a place. So they quickly say, oh, I guess we'll do this. And so they set a time for the conference, famous Charlottetown conference on the 1st of September. And they host it in Charlottetown largely because they're not convinced that the Prince Edward Island delegates would even come if they hosted it in Fredericton or Halifax. So that gives you some idea of Prince Edward Island excitement about Confederation. But I didn't answer your question about what PEI. Yeah. So, I mean, so in terms of what PEI would want, I mean, so the dilemma, and this actually, Peter Waite, the historian, he wrote this great book back in the 60s about Confederation. He said a great line about how, you know, Confederation, you know, is a solution to a Canadian problem. And the Maritimers, you know, the Canadians have to find a way to convince the Maritimers. Mm-hmm. Now, for the New Brunswickers and Nova Scotians, they want a railway. It's a real sense that this could genuinely benefit them. So that's a real practical, fundamental benefit. If you're living on Prince Edward Island, you don't think that benefits you. It doesn't, you know, your access to markets isn't going to come through a railway joining to Canada. It's quite isolated, especially if you're thinking of a time before serious kind of seagoing vessels. It's frozen away for much of the year. They're not even sure that they could, if the capital, of course, is going to be somewhere not in PEI, they're not even sure their delegates can get to the capital and back and forth travel effectively. So they see a lot of potential losses here, a loss of their independence, a loss of their assembly potentially. And, you know, the one benefit I think that they could have been convinced by is if there had been some potential to solve the landlord problem. Mm-hmm. And I can go on a little bit about more of that if you want.
Yes, please.
So back in 1853, a Liberal government, after trying to solve past laws to improve the rights of tenants and having each of these laws essentially annulled or not passed into law by the governor and then the British government, they finally get one law passed, which is this law which says the government will then create a fund to purchase lands themselves from the proprietors and sell them on to tenants. But it's almost completely unsuccessful in doing this. The one estate they purchase ends up being an entirely corrupt boondoggle, where it seems the land agents kind of sold it on at a very overinflated price. So, you know, corruption in Canadian politics is nothing new. But the solution then is they're always looking for capital. The government doesn't have that much money. And so if the Canadians offered a significant amount of capital to go into that fund, then, you know, some people at the time have said, and I think it's probably right, that it could have won over supporters on the island.
So this is interesting. So the famous Charlottetown Conference, like the sort of the beginning of the Confederation Conference, is effectively, as we understand it in sort of the general narrative, is really a conference, as you said, to sort of not trick, but to make it as easy as possible for the PEI delegates to go, because they don't think they are. So broad disinterest. So we have a series of conferences that occur, ultimately leading to Prince Edward Island deciding that they will not join Canada in 1867 with this unfolds. Is the land question the only issue that leads to them backing out?
No, it's not. And let me tell one more anecdote before we get into that story, because I think, because it's not that no one in PEI was supportive. And so there's this one guy, William Pope, and he's got a brother, James Pope, and they come together in interesting ways. And William Pope is the guy, and this is a famously told story in the story of the Confederation, the Charlottetown Conference. You know, when the Canadians are arriving the 1st of September, the day before, the circus is in town. And so when the Canadian ship, the Victoria, arrives in the harbor, the whole cabinet of PEI, they're at the circus like everybody else. Like, they haven't had a circus in 20 years. Everyone's excited. All the hotels are full. And the one guy who gets literally on what was called a bum boat, this little tiny rowboat, and he's sitting on a barrow and he goes out, rows out to see meet the Canadians, is this William Pope. And he's a real keen supporter of Confederation. So there is one guy, poor William Pope. He does do well in the end. But okay. But what is PEI? So you're right. The Charlottetown Conference, they sort of agree. And, you know, I think in the midst of all the champagne drinking, there's some enthusiasm. I think there's a lot of excitement about it, but as the Charlottetown Conference then leads, you know, a month and a half later to the Quebec Conference, and the actual details get worked out about what this will look like, you can see all these divisions emerging, and really especially from PEI, and they're concerned that they will, on the one hand, it's about identity, right? Although the new nation is going to be a federation, so there's still going to be a local government, most of the PEI delegates are pretty convinced that that level of government is going to be tiny and insignificant, right? It's not going to have ability to raise a lot of funds, and it's going to be a kind of like a municipality. So there's that issue. And then the representation in the central government, because of course George Brown is insistent that it be rep by pop, you know, PEI's population, you know, 80 something thousand in the 1860s, they're only going to get 5 seats in the assembly, in the House of Commons. And so one of their delegates pushes it. We can just extend it to 6 seats. And this matters in this, you know, okay, you say, what's the difference of one extra seat? But PEI is divided into 3 counties. And so it would be useful if they could have 2 seats per county, as opposed to this way of dividing it 5 over 3 counties that mathematically doesn't go very well. That just gets shut down at the Quebec Conference. Then there's a question of the Senate, right? The Senate is such a weird document. It becomes this huge issue of debate at the Quebec conference, even though the Senate is such a ultimately not very meaningful institution, but it becomes this proxy by which the Maritimers and PEI especially say, you know, what's our status here? How many seats are we going to get in it? Because the Canadians see this, and I think mostly the New Brunswickers and Nova Scotians sort of agree, is that the joining of British North America is a union of three different sections. And in terms of population, they're kind of right. There's Upper Canada, there's Lower Canada, and there's the Maritimes. And at Charlottetown, they sort of agree with that. But then at Quebec, all of a sudden you get these people from Newfoundland coming in who weren't at the Charlottetown conference. And so you get this weird debate of how many seats these colonies from the Maritimes are each going to get in the Senate, and it becomes this major sticking point. And I, you know, ultimately, PEI doesn't get what they want. Well, they sort of agree that the Newfoundland will be treated separately than the others, and they sort of get what they want, but it still rankles the PEI delegates. So it's that kind of issues of identity. And at the Charlottetown, sorry, the Quebec conference, the whole issue of money for land purchases, it just goes nowhere. It's just dropped.
Right.
So the one real incentive that could have been used to lure them in is just not significant. Now, you might say, why is this the case? And I think the thing is, for the Canadians, who are the real movers at the conference, they're moving almost every, you know, all these resolutions to put things together. They need New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. They need the rail link. They need the ice-free port on the Atlantic. You know, people forget that the rail port, when the Grand Trunk Railway, it ends up in Portland, Maine at this time. Like, you take that railway up through Lower Canada to, you know, various spots, and then it heads through the United States into Portland, Maine, and it heads off that way. The British North America, certainly the Canadians, don't have a railway-linked ice-free port. So they need Nova Scotia and New Brunswick to provide that. That's who they really care about. So PEI doesn't really matter as much to them, I think.
That's really interesting. And it's interesting that you said how Newfoundland was going to be treated differently, because today, of course, when you say Maritimes, that Newfoundland's not included in the concept of the Maritimes. Like people from Newfoundland wouldn't identify as Maritimers in the PEI, New Brunswick, Nova Scotian way, which is really interesting. So, okay, this is great. So you have this situation where PEI, like you said, this ice-free port is kind of crucial. It makes New Brunswick and Nova Scotia strategically and economically so vital to the Confederation project. PEI, you know, good addition, but there's not really any impetus on both sides, it seems like, to really make a deal that can stick, to really like dangle the carrot that will finally work. And then, of course, as we know from 1867 into the early 1870s, things begin to change. And maybe you could comment on what does change, because obviously the attitudes on both sides are changed dramatically during this period.
Yeah. So obviously there's the whole story about after the Quebec conference, things almost fall apart. You know, the Canadians quickly agree to the Quebec resolutions, and they say, yes, we're going to do this. It goes through the assembly. It's fine. But, you know, famously, New Brunswick, they have to have an election. Yep. and the premier there says, we can't pass these resolutions before we have an election. It has to be done then. And New Brunswick defeats the government, and an anti-Confederation government comes in. And there's this whole long story that ultimately ends up at another conference in London late 1866, coming into 1867. And, you know, a deal gets worked out. And interestingly, the two maritime premiers who are in London, while they're waiting for the Canadians to arrive in London, because the Canadians are very delayed arriving in London, they float an idea that, oh, maybe we could find $800,000 to help fund the land purchases. So they're still on Prince Edward Island. So they're still at the last minute floating ideas, but it's rejected by PEI and I think by the Canadians. So anyway, Confederation happens the 1st of July, officially 1867. The new Dominion of Canada is created. And in PEI, there's really a sense initially that's just absolutely fine by them. It had been a Tory government, a new Liberal government comes in, gets elected in 1867. In fact, the other great proponent of Confederation in Prince Edward Island, this fascinating guy, Edward Whalen, who's this journalist and really a fascinating a journalist, interesting guy, Irish Catholic. He's kind of like the Darcy McGee of Prince Edward Island. He loses an election. He's going to be presented to the cabinet, but he's the one Liberal who's a real pro-Confederate. And for various reasons, he loses his election. And so that's a real sense that on Prince Edward Island, the politicians feel that, you know, this public sentiment is really against Confederation. It just doesn't seem to offer them anything, and it only presents these losses. And it probably, it seems, would have stayed that way, except most historians say the one thing that gets in the way is railways, and not the intercolonial railway. But in 1871, the Prince Edward Islanders decide that they're going to build their own railway. They're going to build their own railway, which kind of loops across from the east to west, one side of the island to the other. And like all railway stories of the 19th century, the story of the PEI railway was one of incredible corruption, boondoggle, and just chaos. And so they don't set the railway up correctly. And so there's all this lobbying to have the different railway junctions come to certain communities and not others. And so you get this really winding railway, which the government's going to have it's going to be a fee per mile, but the cost is just expanding. And, you know, the governments in the mid-19th century, they don't have very, very good ways of raising taxes, right? Taxes, government money comes from tariffs. They just don't have the economic resources. So 1871, they decide it. They start building right away. And it's clear by the next year, by 1872, that the railway is in significant debt, and the government sponsoring it has all these responsibilities, and they're stuck. They're gonna have all this incredible financial chaos. But the thing is, they know that one of the promises to New Brunswick and Nova Scotia when they joined into the Dominion of Canada was that the new Dominion government would take over all the debts of the colonies coming into it. And New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, both who had been building these, you know, partially built railways, that was a real also incentive for them that they would get their debt taken over by the national government. And so it becomes clear that is the real thing, which is to Prince Edward Island politicians say, well, actually, maybe there could be a real incentive to do this. And so I think that's what pushes them into saying, okay, going to Ottawa and negotiating things. And I mean, I suppose the second other thing is that they realize that, you know, they had hoped to, negotiate reciprocity, kind of free trade with the Americans, which had been in existence from the mid-1850s to the mid-1860s. The Canadians had wanted that as well. But after the American Civil War, the Americans just were uninterested in reciprocity at that time for various reasons. And so PEI finds that it just doesn't have the independence to negotiate that on its own behalf. It's actually subservient in some ways to the new Dominion of Canada in terms of the fisheries. Its lieutenant governor is still has to answer to the broader governor general of British North America, who's in Ottawa. You know, they just don't have the independence of movement that they thought they might have had, and so there's more of a sense that they might benefit from joining this Dominion, especially in terms of taking over of debts. And the last thing is, you know, when they go to Ottawa and they eventually ultimately negotiate, you know, the governor, Johnny MacDonald, is actually pretty open to giving them what they want. And so when they actually begin the negotiations, they do provide some funds to make the land purchases, right? So they're trying to bring them in. And they get their six MPs, not their five members of parliament. So they ultimately, you could say, I mean, when Prince Edward Island comes into Confederation, they kind of get what they wanted in a way that people in Nova Scotia, you know, obviously who they came in, but then furiously resented it, didn't.
That's really interesting. So PEI kind of holds out and eventually gets kind of everything they wanted. They get the money for the land question. They get their debt taken by the Dominion of Canada. They get the six seats they wanted. This is kind of an interesting thought, but I wonder how much of 1873 and the decision to give PEI everything they want is reflective of John A. MacDonald's vision of really expanding the country as rapidly as possible and as much as possible. We know that BC joins in 71. We know that Manitoba joins in 71. We know that there's very significant issues in the Red River, Manitoba area. There is this sort of drive to really get everyone in. And I wonder if that plays, what do you think, just as your thoughts, do you think that plays a part in John A. MacDonald's sort of openness to PEI getting all these things?
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I would say is, you know, that vision of an expanded British North America, it's already there in 1860s as well, 1867. Okay. It's just, so that's absolutely, that vision is already there. It's there in George Brown's mind. It's all of these people are keen to do that. It's just, I think that by 1873, they're just implementing it. They're signing numbered treaties across the prairies. They're, and maybe even more importantly, the one thing you didn't mention is they, you know, because Joseph Howe, the great father of responsible government of Nova Scotia, gets elected, you know, in Nova Scotia as a slate right after Confederation, as a slate of anti-Confederates, right? And Johnny Macdonald very effectively wins Howe over, and there's a whole negotiation of better terms for Nova Scotia. So by 1873, he's used to doing this. They've been winning over the different allies in these different areas, and you know, Justin Macdonald tries to do in the West as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you frame that in that context. I think that's important. So this is an interesting question. What was the reaction of Prince Edward Islanders to Confederation?
When it finally happens?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, I mean, I don't think it's overwhelming joy and excitement. Amongst the popular press, you know, I think there's not a great deal of resentment. So you don't get what you get in Nova Scotia or in some ways New Brunswick. This, you don't have this legacy of a sense that PEI was brought in against its will. I mean, in some ways you still have this in Newfoundland, even though there's the referendum, right? And, the sense of being betrayed, and PEI doesn't really have that legacy. So that's one thing. And then I would say amongst the political class, it's relief that the railway debt is taken care of. And that's such a key factor.
I've heard this anecdote, and maybe you know it, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but that when Prince Edward Island finally joined, so in 73, the story goes that the sheriff of Charlottetown went up on a balcony and sort of read out the announcement to a crowd that was relatively disinterested in the whole notion whatsoever. I don't know, have you ever heard this anecdote at all?
I don't know that anecdote, but I mean, it just fits with that, with the whole story. I mean, and to a certain extent, you know, I say this when I talk about the history of Confederation. To a certain extent, Confederation, I mean, there is some excitement. You don't want to overdo that, but it's not the pinnacle of political achievement. I always make the case that the real story that I think we ought to celebrate way more than we do even Confederation is the story of responsible government. Mm-hmm. And that's a story at the end of the 1840s and 1850s, the real winning for local people in British North America and PEI and Nova Scotia, first in Nova Scotia and Ontario and Quebec, winning the ability to, you know, have our own democratic institutions as we wanted them in the 1860s, which is to say we wanted British institutions within a British empire. And it's at that moment that, you know, if you're looking for political principles that people can really celebrate and be proud of, that's the moment. The pragmatic story of Confederation is an ambitious story of spreading a nation, but I would say it's not even, probably not even as important as the story of responsible government.
I want to thank you all for listening today. Don't forget, you can find me on Twitter at Doc Boris. That's at DocBorys. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Patreon. And you can find us on all podcast listening devices. And please do not hesitate to write and leave a comment. We love to hear from you. I'm David Boris. Stay curious, friends.